Okay, so sorry about any confusion about whether we're going to have lecture here or not. I didn't realize how explicitly I said in the syllabus that I was going to post that one online. But I was planning to do a trip to Japan this week to work on a neutrino experiment. And then the lawyers decided that the closing on the house I was about to buy had to happen when I was supposed to be landing in Japan. So I had to cancel the trip. But since I'm here, so anyway, you're the ones who are making it. So for those of you who aren't here today because of the confusion, my apologies. I hope to have the exam back to you Tuesday or Thursday of this next week. We're going to aim for Tuesday. You don't have class Tuesday, so okay. make it Thursday, then. That's good news. And I've been meaning to start the conversation about what we're going to do for the project soon. Basically, I'm going to send out a list of what I think are sort of interesting things that have some association with class that many of you might find interesting to learn more about, which are not the kinds of things that I'll feel obligated to cover in class. And then I'll probably put out some sort of an online poll, and you can pick things that you're, or maybe ask you to download in our hard copy. And then pick several of them that you're interested in and give me a rank ordering, and then I'll try to divide you up into groups based on interest, and then we'll go from there. So I'll send an email about that soon. Okay, anything about the class? Okay. Most of you are here at the end of the exam, so that is usually means there's at least something in there that you're having a tough time with. Just a reminder, my exam means are very often about 65, so it's not unusual to be frustrated. So I wouldn't put any energy into any feelings of frustration about it now. It's to me, it's a good exam if you feel a bit like you got hit by a truck before you walk out, because I like to spread it out a little bit. I want to challenge you, but at the same time, I want to have some stuff on there that's pretty straightforward. So all that goes to say, you have no idea how you did until we actually grade it, and I can have the mean and I can interpret all that for you. If indeed it was excessively hard and everybody got their butt kicked, then the mean's going to be very low, and doesn't necessarily mean that you did particularly bad. It may mean that it was just not a very good test, or vice versa. But given that everybody was in here at the end, it probably wasn't too easy. Okay. All right, so last time we were looking at current and resistance. So current meaning if you put a potential across the substance and you can get charge flowing as a function of time, if you measure that, we call that the current, and it's measured in units of amperes in MKS. And then, of course, it doesn't happen really straightforward, so the analogy that I have in mind is imagine an electron moving through the substance but running into things. So the analogy is if you're trying to make it across the quad, you get a hug from your honey, and you have a lot of people in the quad and you keep running into people. So I think resistance is electrons impeded as they look for those or whatever. Now, if we put a bigger potential difference across this, the electric field is greater, so you will have more force on the charges, and you'll get more current in general. But there is a material-dependent resistance to this, and If you look at the proportionality between the potential and the current, we get in most materials, in many materials, over a pretty reasonable range, you have a linear relationship. I did not say all materials, and I did not say all voltages. So you sometimes may need to worry about whether, if you're actually doing something real in the lab, and you have a substance, there may be regions, you may run something at a voltage where, in fact, you have nonlinear resistance or something, and if you approximated things or you need it to be linear for some reason, then you can have a problem. When you're measuring things using a resistance, for example, it's really nice if it's linear, but if it's slightly nonlinear, then you better know that nonlinearity or your measurements are going to be off. So linearity of the resistance is very important sometimes. We will generally only use Ohm's law, and we will assume linearity in this class, but in the real world, you might be sure that you need to ask about that or investigate it sometimes. So the resistance is measured in ohms, and it will depend not only on the material but also on the geometry. So if you have a resistor that's has a large cross section, then the current has more places to go and it's easier for it to get through. If you take that same amount of material and you spread it out into a thin thing, now all the current's got to go through the same path, and the resistance is going to be much, much greater. And in fact, there's a relationship, resistivity, and I think I've given you a couple of problems, so you can look at that. And we'll do a demo next class, which is sort of fun, where we'll also look at that. So ampere comes from, it's named after this guy, who was a French mathematician, chemist, physicist. Things were a little bit more, less compartmentalized back in the day. So at any rate, he lived in the late 1700s, early 1800s. Oops. Ohm is named after this guy, and he's a German, lived about the same time. And the other thing I wanted to point out was the symbol that we use for ohm. Okay, so if we're in MKF, the current unit is the ampere, and the voltage unit is the volt. So the resistance unit is the ohm, and generally this is the symbol that's used. So very often you'll be dealing with something that is in kiloohms or mega ohms, so there'll be a small k in an ohm symbol, or a big M in an ohm symbol. If you're shoving current through a material and the current elements keep hitting the elements of the material itself, so they basically impart energy to the material and lose energy, this is sort of the microscopic essence of what resistance is, that energy turns into heat in the material. So we call it resistive heating, and it is pretty efficient, actually, in terms of heating things. And last time we derived the power, that is the heat per unit time that's generated if you have a resistance in the circuit. And there are three different forms using Ohm's law to just go from one form to the other. And so basically you in given problems may find yourself needing to use different forms of this equation, so get used to them. And then we've also looked at if you have in a circuit, two of the major elements that you might distribute around the circuit are resistors and capacitors. And earlier we looked at capacitors, and in any given circuit you'll have a capacitance, and very often that capacitance can't be treated as just a single capacitance. It may be treated as that, but when you look at the circuit, it will actually come from many different places. So very often, what you want to do is to look at the circuit and somehow look at that entire capacitance or a piece of the circuit and condense it into a single value. And so if the capacitors are in parallel, you use this formula. In series, you use that formula. And resistors, we derived last time
You have a similar thing. If you have a bunch of resistors in a circuit, you very often may want to figure out how to think of those resistors as if they were a single resistance. And again, it depends on whether they're in parallel or series. And the confusing thing here that you just want to keep track of is that there is this basic pattern that you see, but it's flipped between the resistances and the capacitors. So resistors in series, you just sum them up in series. Capacitances in series is the sum of the inverses. And in parallel, it's the opposite. So in the heat of an exam, sometimes you can get those things flipped. So be really careful with that. And so I always go back and try to remember. If I had a formula sheet, I might write it down. But the way that I think about it is it's very easy for me intuitively to think that if I have multiple resistances that are in series, I have to run through each of them in order to get where I want to go. So the total resistance just sums up. So that's what makes intuitive sense to me. And then I know in parallel, it's the inverse relationship, and capacitors, it's flipped. So that's how I can always reconstruct this. All right, so let's think about this for a moment. I have here some light bulbs, and I can get different circuits by flipping switches in certain ways. So what I'd like you to imagine is that I set up this circuit. We'll assume each light bulb works by virtue of its having a resistor inside it, and you put a potential difference across it, you generate a lot of new light. So suppose that I place two resistors in series, and that branch of the circuit is in parallel with one resistor. Okay? And I now put a voltage across both of those. So what I would like you to think about is, what is the rank ordering of the brightness of those three resistors? What do you think? Will they be the same? Will any of them be the same? What do you think?
A and B will be the same.
Why?
Because they're not so hard.
So A and B, by virtue of this, that the current is going to split between the lower and the bottom, so the total current split. And without worrying about what's bigger or smaller at the moment, then that current which goes on the upper path has to go through both A and B. Now, that means they both have the same current, and the brightness goes as the power, right? Because the brightness is the dissipation of the energy in the resistance. That's the way to think about it.
So let's say that we have an I, and that I is going to go into an I1 up top and an I2 at the bottom. And remember that power is equal to I squared R. So we know that on the top half, the current's the same through both. And by virtue of these all being the same type of bulb, and I have the same symbols there, you can think of those resistances as being the same. So the dissipation of power is going to be the same in each of these. So I would expect these two to be the same brightness. If these resistances were different, then that might not be, that won't be the case. All right, so now, what about the top and the bottom? What do you think? Okay, so he says they'll be different based on the fact that the resistances are different. You'll have different currents in the branch. Anything else? So you think the top will have be brighter? Okay. So let's think our way through that a little bit. So we have the same potential across each of these. So on the top, V is equal to I times 2R because they're in series. So I is equal to V over 2R. I guess use the little R's. On the bottom, V is equal to IR, so the current on the bottom is equal to V over R. So that means on the top, you have the power goes as V squared over 4, R squared over the R there. So this becomes V squared divided by R. By 4R. And on the bottom, the power goes as V squared over R. So I think the power is going to be bigger on the bottom. So I would guess the bottom will be brighter. So let's see if I can set this up right. Those two will go off, and then I'm going to have keep that off, and I'll have one here. This path doesn't exist, so the path that's connected is going to be through here. But I thought I had this, so I can get this exact configuration easily. So if I turn this one on, unscrew that one, now this connects through here, here, down to there. This is off. Okay, so these two should go on, and that one will go on, that will go off. Okay, so here are the two up top, here's the one at the bottom. Okay? All right.
I'll leave the configuration the same, except now what will happen if I unscrew that bulb? I'm sorry. Let me unscrew this bulb. So let me unscrew bulb A. Yeah.
It will just be equal brightness, B and C.
Okay, so we have a hypothesis that B and C will be of equal brightness.
You'll only get low through C.
Why?
Because you took that element on the circuit so that it's not connected.
Okay, so B and C will be the same brightness, or B will be off because we've broken the circuit there, and C will be on. What do you think? The way it's set up, that light bulb is in series. So if I remove it, it's going to break that circuit. So there's no current that flows through B. So B will be off. So is the brightness of C, when I unscrew A, is the brightness of C going to be dimmer, the same, or brighter? Do you think dimmer? Raise your hand. The same? Brighter. What happened? Why does it stay the same?
Because the no current going through it in the first place?
No, it's bright, so there's current going through it.
On the top, there's no current going through A because it's
screwed. Yeah, but if I screw it in, why is it this one does not change in brightness regardless of what I do here? Why? Okay.
Because it has to cover the same voltage regardless.
Right. The total current may have changed, but not the current through this loop, because they're both at the same voltage. Right. I haven't changed the voltage across C at all. All I've done is break the other circuit. So the current through the lower loop stays the same. So the total current draw in the circuit is less. But all I've done is reduce it by the amount that goes through the top. Okay? Okay, so let's think about a circuit, a simple circuit, and think about what's happening with the potential in the system as we go around the circuit. So let me start out with an EMF, and then very often you will note that EMFs come with a little resistor associated with them. And that, when you do see it, is called the internal resistance. All real batteries will actually have a little resistance in them. So, you have to worry about that sometimes. If it's not mentioned and it's not shown, then don't worry about it. So it's not always there. In the problems that you do.
So very often, the battery actually looks something like that, where you can think of it as containing this little resistance. In this case, let's assume the little resistance is there. We'll call it little r. And then we'll have the conductor go around and encounter a bigger r. And then we'll have it come back to the battery. And so that we can make a one-dimensional graph of this, I want to denote two points on this thing. Let's call this point B, which is to the positive side of this EMF plus resistor. And then I'll call point A on the other side. And what I would like to do is to sort of trace what's happening with the potential of the system as we go from A to B and back to A. Sometimes in this part of the course, these and these sort of script E's are used sort of interchangeably. But what I want to do is to plot the potential in the circuit as a function of where we are in the circuit. Now, for those of you who are really paying attention, you probably are very concerned at the moment, because I seem to be talking about an absolute potential. But to do that, I have to define what I mean by zero, right? So rest easy. We're going to say that the potential at A is where we define the potential to be zero. So we can imagine that we'll have the circuit. If I split it and lay it out, we have A here. Then we have the EMF, the little resistor. Point B is here. Let me spread it out a little bit. We have the little resistor. Point B is here. Go through the big resistor. And then we come all the way back to point A. So that's the way I want to look at it. All right, so if we define the point at point A to be the zero of potential in the circuit, then the wire that goes between A and that point has to be at the same potential because it's just a conductor. So we'll have it starting out at zero. What does the EMF do? The EMF is a device that basically adds potential energy to the system. So the potential is going to increase when you go across the EMF, going from the negative to the positive side. Remember that positive direction is the direction of positive current flow in circuit stuff. So that means we have a big rise in the potential as we go across the EMF. How high do we go? Well, we go to the value of that EMF, whatever it is. And then we sort of, we'll say that we traverse, this happens as you sort of traverse it. So we say that it rises. Then, so now you have got things at a higher potential, and the conductor that's connected to that battery on the other side then stays at that potential. And now, if you traverse the resistor with a current, V is equal to IR. That's a voltage drop. That's how much energy you lose going through that resistor. So the potential on the circuit now will drop as you go across the resistor. And the amount that it drops is equal to the current that you have times R. So I forgot to say, of course, we have a current in here. Once you get to the other side of the resistor, the current stays the same. I mean, the resistance, the potential stays the same because you're just on a conductor. Through point B, all the way to the big resistance, R, and if you look at the other side of the big resistance, you're hitting the conductor that's connected to point A. Which means the other side of the big resistance has to be at the same potential as point A, which we've defined as our zero. So that means you have to drop all the way back down to zero and then come back to the start. And this drop is equal to the same current because these resistors are in series. So think of it as a water pipe. If I put water in one end, it has to come out the other end. And the flow has to be the same at every point in the pipe if it's the same cross-sectional area. So the voltage drop across the big resistor is IR. You okay with that? All right. So this stuff is easy. So circuits should be pretty easy. Let's look at another example. Let's imagine that we have a resistor connected to an EMF, connected to another resistor, connected to another resistor, connected to an EMF going the other way, connected to an EMF going that way, connected to a resistor, connected to another resistor, going like so, and then for fun we'll do this, and maybe that. Oh, and then we'll have a resistor there. Resistor, EMF. Okay, let's do that. I mean, you look at that. You can't even if I gave you the values, if you look at that. Okay, I speak only for myself. For I am here mortal. But when I look at that, I have no idea even what direction the current is going, much less how big it is through any part of the circuit, right? So circuits can be arbitrarily complicated. However, they can be solved. The current flow in these circuits can basically be solved. We're going to do... We're going to think of, in particular, one type of circuit right now, and then we'll come back to another in a while, later in the course. So you can imagine a circuit where you have EMFs and you have resistances, and you think of this thing as being in a steady state. And when you have that kind of thing, in a steady state, what do I mean by that? Let's say that the EMFs produce a fixed voltage at all times. Let's think of it that way. And when you have that, then it's called direct current, or DC. So this is basically if you take just a little battery and you connect it to a circuit. All that battery does is it puts a potential difference across those poles. And as long as the battery still has its chemical processes going on, that potential difference is fixed. It stays the same. Okay? For reasons that we will see later in the course, sometimes it is a lot simpler practically to create a device that creates a voltage across it, so an EMF that creates a voltage that actually changes in time, quite literally will flip back and forth up to a higher value. And this is something which is called an alternating current. Or AC. I think we blew it here because direct current isn't really that obvious. Alternating current's a little bit easy. So this is one where we should have probably renamed it, put in some arbitrary symbols or something, because that's a little bit straightforward. But just bear in mind, things change a lot when you are varying a voltage. You get time dependencies across all of the elements of the circuit. And so AC circuits and thinking your way through AC circuits is very different from doing DC circuits. So we're about to learn to think our way through DC circuits. This is insufficient should you choose to wire your house. Don't think that you know what you're doing, especially with AC circuit, AC stuff. We will do a little bit of AC work, but even there, I'd be very careful about trying to do it on your own. You learn very practically what you need to do and what the code is, and have someone, they may not know what current is, but they know how to hook up the wires in your house to keep it from burning down. So take that very seriously. So right now, what we're going to do is sort of thinking about things in a DC sort of way. The basic philosophy, well, the principles that we're going to use in DC circuits are exactly what you use in AC circuits, but there are some differences in how things operate. So we'll do a little bit with AC later in the class. All right. So there are a couple of basic ideas that you can use to solve circuits. And we use what are called Kirchhoff's rules. And here's the guy, Kirchhoff, who thought about these when he was at a tender young age. And he does look like he played for ZZ Top or whatever. So one you've already seen, and it sort of has to be the case. In any circuit, if you start at a certain point and you look at that potential in the circuit and you follow the circuit on any path, any independent path you wish, if you come back to that point, the total change in the potential is zero. It has to be, because you can't have double value potential at the same point of a conductor. Right? So if you start out at the ground floor of Bausch and Lomb and you walk up to the fifth floor and then walk back down to the ground floor, you're back to the same height, right? And it doesn't matter whether you walk up by the lobby, walk down the hall, and then go down the stairs and then walk up to the same point in the lobby. Your height hasn't changed. So that's exactly the way it is with circuits. You may think, well, why do I really care? And why you care is because you can take any given circuit and you can trace out an independent path in that circuit and sum up all the voltages, and that gives you an equation. And you can do that for as many different independent paths as exist in that circuit, and that generates a bunch of equations. And I know you're very excited about the fact that if you have lots of equations, you can solve for lots of unknowns. Right? So, the types of things you can use to get equations are, you can look at a circuit, regardless of its complexity, And you can create independent paths, sum the voltages up, set that equal to zero, and boom, you've got an equation. The other thing you can do is that you have current conservation. If I have current and I hit a junction, the current splits. How much current goes this way and how much current goes that way depends on all the other crap that's going on in the circuit. Okay? I don't know what those currents are, but I know that there's a relationship between the current in each of the branches at that point. Okay? And so, there you go. So basically, you apply this at every junction. You apply this to all the loops, and you get n independent equations, and you can solve for them. So what makes this hard? If it's a complicated circuit, you get a lot of equations and a lot of variables, and the algebra becomes just ridiculous. I may expose you to a little bit of that so that you will respect the fact that it's horrible. And I'm sure it was done to me, so I have to do it to you. But I won't do much of that. But also I want you to appreciate the fact how easy the exam problems are when you realize how hard they could be in terms of annoyance and doing these things. But basically, you just do this. That's the physics. Okay, so we're going to look at some things. So there are three things that you have to do that to get across. To make this work, there's sort of three things that have to come together. One is you need to have some guts. All right? What do I mean by that? There's your circuit. I might label the resistances. Now what? I don't know what direction the current's going. So you just have to choose. You say, we're going to have current 1 go like that. And then we'll say at that junction it breaks into currents 2 and 3. And I'm going to make them go that way because it looks cool if 1 is going that way. And then this current will split here and here into 4 and 5. This one goes to, that one's now established. So that's 4 coming in. And we'll call that current 6. And then they all come together, but now I've already defined that current. Okay? I may have chosen the direction of every one of those currents to be incorrect, or half of them, or whatever. When I set up my equations, I'm going to set them up in such a way that I have chosen those directions of the currents. That's the first thing I do, is I'll label the direction of all those currents. And I will set up the equations assuming that. And when we do that, what we'll find is there are very particular conventions we use on how we sum the voltages up that depend on, as you're going around your chosen path, whether you're going with the current or against the current, and it flips the algebraic sign. And if you keep all of that straight, if when you first labeled that circuit, you have the current labeled in the wrong direction, when you numerically solve things at the end, that current will come out negative. And when you see a negative current at the very end, you know that it is going the opposite direction from the way in which you first chose. All right? Yes?
Even if you knew all the voltages of the batteries and which directions they were going, would you still not know the way the current would go?
Well, you may know. I may set up the problem where I give you the currents and even their directions, and I'm asking you resistances or voltages. It's all tied together, this is there. Okay? And so, everything I was saying was just contingent on the fact that it's the currents that I have you solving for instead of the resistances. But the thing is, of the EMFs, the currents, and the resistances that are in the circuit, depending on how the circuit's set up, you can have n unknowns for however many equations you can get. That's really what it comes down to. But very often, the scariest part initially is you don't know what the direction of the currents are. That's not to say you won't occasionally see a problem where your intuition will give you a pretty good idea of what direction the current's probably going. And in fact, it's fine to use that. and use it because it may make you feel a little more warm and fuzzy about that initial first step. So that's why I say it takes some guts, because you have to sort of jump in even though you know nothing about it. Okay, so you have to make assumptions on the currents if you aren't given those. Then we'll go through the conventions that we're going to use in just a moment. So you then have to trace out, you then have all of the current equations, that is current conservation, which is given by the fact that you have current coming in and out of junctions. So if, for example, I have current 1 coming in and currents 2 and 3 leaving at that junction, I would have the equation I would have for relating those would be I1 is equal to I2 plus I3, or I1, because the current coming in is positive, I2 and I3 are each negative because the current's leaving. All right, so you have to keep all of that straight. And you also have to worry about independence again, because, for example, you have a bunch of currents coming back together up here. So by the time you get up here, you've actually already used all that information. So you don't get an additional equation when you work up there. So as you go around the various loops that you choose to do, usually like here, here, and here, they have to be independent, which means each path that you take has to have within it at least some component of the circuit that is not included in any of the other paths that you've taken. So in this case, if I took this as a loop, that as a loop, and that as a loop, I would have 3 independent loops. That's 3 independent equations. And you can usually, if it's not a ridiculous circuit like the one I drew up a minute ago, you can look at it and tell topologically how many equations you should get for the sum, the voltage sum. Topologically, you have sort of the 3 holes here, and they'll each give you, because they each contain independent components if you were to do it like that. So then you sum the voltages up using the conventions that we're going to go through in a second, and you just have to be consistent throughout. Once you choose the directions of these currents, then you have to be religious about those conventions all the way through. And if you do that, it's just algebra for solving. The physics is all here. Okay? If it is a really complicated circuit, you can sort of do the same thing, but you do it on a computer. And you might do it with searching the space or something. So it might be a bit different. But there are massive programs that can solve that kind of thing. All right, so what conventions do we use? How many of you have had ECE 210? Good. I think I was doing this for 123 or 122 or something. And there were a bunch of engineers in the class. And we were well into the semester, and they finally told me I was using a convention that was exactly opposite from what they had in their other class. So I had, up until that point, had no idea that the engineers used a different convention for this. But they might, so be careful of that if you end up in some other class. But the convention we're going to use is what I learned and I find in all the physics textbooks. So, whatever. Here's a circuit. You pick the directions for your currents, and now you choose a path, some loop in that circuit, and you pretend that you're sort of traversing that loop, and you want to sum the voltages. And you do this mentally, basically, as you look at the circuit. And so the question is, or the voltages are pretty clear. If you traverse a battery, the voltage absolute magnitude that you use is going to be the EMF of that battery. Because depending on which direction you're going through that battery, you're either going to increase the voltage or decrease the voltage that much as you sort of traverse that element of the circuit. As you go across a resistor, the amount of the potential that's going to change is going to be IR. And so then the question is whether we consider that a voltage drop or a voltage rise. And that depends on the direction of the current and how you're traversing the loop. So the convention that we use when we traverse loops are, for the EMFs, if you are mentally traversing an EMF in the direction of the EMF, that is going from the negative to the positive, then we say that in the voltage sum, you increase the voltage by a positive the amount of the battery. Okay? If you traverse the battery going the other way, that is, you're going from positive to negative, then in the voltage sum, the EMF comes in with a negative sign. Alright? For resistances, we say that if you are going in the direction of the current, you have a voltage drop. That is, it comes in with a negative IR. If you are traversing, if your loop is traversing the resistor against the current, then we say it's a positive IR. All right? Those are the conventions. So let's go through something a little more carefully then. So let us imagine that we have a circuit that looks like this. There's our circuit, and let's say that when I give you the problem, we say that you know the values of EMF 1 and EMF 2, and I can give you the values of the resistances, R1, R2, R3. And what you want to solve for the current, throughout the circuit. Pick a point on the circuit. I want you to be able to tell me what the current is. Okay? So that's the problem. That's how you would find it on an exam or something, potentially. So to do this, the first thing you need to do is to decide what direction your currents are and make up currents that are in the circuit. So we'll just, I have no idea what direction they're going to go. The actual direction will depend on the actual values here, right? So in this problem, I might actually give you the real numbers and then ask you to give, but it doesn't matter. We're going to, now looking at this circuit, we'll just start making stuff up. Let's just say that in this branch we have a current I1 that goes that way. Okay, it goes counterclockwise. And then that I1 continues on, so you clearly have an I1 right here, because that's all one pipe, one conductor. And let's say when that current meets the junction, we'll say that there's a split. And we'll call this I2 going into the right-hand loop. And we have to pick a direction for the other, so we'll just say that we have an I3 coming down in the middle. So at this junction, we're going to pretend for the moment that we have a current coming in and a current coming in, and they both combine and give you that current. So this could be wrong. But it doesn't matter. If they're wrong, when I algebraically sign things and solve it, I'll get a negative sign. Okay? So I don't actually care which direction it's going. I just have to be consistent. Alright. So how many independent current equations do I have? I heard a very meek one. We know we have at least one, right? So let's say we have this one. We have an I1 plus an I3 is equal to an I2. Or you can say incoming is positive, outgoing is negative, and the sum of the currents at this point is plus I3 plus I1 minus I2. It doesn't matter how you decide to do that. But now when I come up here, I have an equation that would involve I1, I3, and I2, and there's no independent new information in that. So that one is not an independent equation, so I can't use it.
So I1 plus I3 has to equal I2. How many independent loop equations should I have?
Suppose I choose this and this. Those all would contain independent elements. So I certainly can have two loops. What about if in addition I choose this? I could use that as one of the loops, but if I do, and I have these others as loops, note that this one does not contain any new element if I have both this one and that one. So it does me no good, and I can't use it. I could choose this path and this path if I wish. Those would be independent. I could choose this path and this path. Those would be independent. Or I could do this and this. But there are two independent equations here. The other way that you can have an inkling of that is if you look at it and you say there are two topological loops and each loop has some element that the other loop doesn't have. So there are two independent equations. What loop do you choose? It doesn't matter, but you have to, once it's chosen, be consistent. So I'm going to just choose this as loop one, and I will choose this as loop two. It doesn't matter whether I go clockwise or counterclockwise mentally as I do this loop. It just matters that once I decide, I stay consistent throughout the problem. I could do one clockwise and one counterclockwise. That's fine. It's just when I set things up, I have to be consistent throughout that loop. There's a question or comment?
If you're trying to solve for two variables, why don't you need three equations?
There's one, and then I'll get two and three.
Oh, that's horrible. Okay.
Okay.
So now we want to do loop one. Where do you start doing this loop? Doesn't matter. So what I'm going to do is what I have is I will say that I'll start right here. And I'm going to go around loop one like that. Mentally, you start here and you mentally start traversing the loop. In this case, we'll go counterclockwise. If I start here, I encounter the first circuit element, which is EMF1. When I encounter it, as I move across it, I'm going in the direction of the current. So it comes in with a positive sign. So I get EMF1.
Then I continue mentally going on the loop and I run across the resistance R1. When I run across R1, I am going in the direction of current 1, so I have a voltage drop, so it comes in with a minus sign.
So this is minus I1 R1.
Then I continue on, there's nothing, and now I come back up here mentally. And this time I'm traversing R3, but I'm traversing it against the current I3 as I've chosen it. So it comes in with a positive sign. So plus I3 R3. And then I'm back up to where I started, and the sum of those voltages has to be equal to zero. So here's equation one, here's equation two, and now to get equation three, we look at loop two. Let's start here and do the same thing. We're now traversing EMF two, but I'm going from positive to negative, so I'm going backwards through it as I traverse it. Doesn't matter the direction of the current. Okay, for the EMFs. It's the direction that you're mentally traversing. So that means as I'm going across here, it's going to come in with the minus sign. So I have minus EMF 2. I come down, I go through R3 in the direction of I3. So I have a plus I3 R3. And now I come back around and I go through R2 in the direction of I2. So I have... No, you guys didn't catch me. Sorry, I'm coming through R3 in the direction of I3, so it's a voltage drop. So I have a minus I3, R3. Then I'm going through R2 in the direction of I2, so I have a minus I2, R2. And all of that is equal to zero, and that's my third equation. And now if you're given the two EMFs and three resistances, you have three equations and three unknowns, and you can solve algebraically. And it will actually work if you have not dropped the sign or changed the convention in root, and which, you know, I made a mistake right there. That's very hard to keep all this straight. And it's also, the other thing is you get all these subscripts, and it's very easy to sort of find yourself putting the current with the wrong subscript or the resistance with the wrong subscript. And if you do that, you're screwed. So you drop a single sign, flip the convention mentally the wrong way, use a loop that's not independent, or you drop a subscript or change it or something, the whole set of equations cannot possibly give you the right answer. So these are a little tedious, but they're easy if you're careful. Okay? You'll probably learn to hate it, but you do want to do some of it so that you get good and get the conventions. And then you can imagine that if I give you a very complicated circuit and I have you start with a clean slate, then you will all choose different conventions for everything. And if my TA shot me after trying to grade some of those, it would be classified as justifiable homicide. So I have to be really careful when I ask you to do things on exam. So I will do things like specify enough information to force you into certain loops or certain current or something like that. Or I will just ask you for the equations or something. And also, I have to be very careful how many loops I give you, because seven equations and seven unknowns is a little hard to do in an hour and a half. So don't, if you're doing something that's a bit more complex than a problem set or whatever, don't worry about it showing up in that form on an exam. I have to be really careful about that, because it becomes enormously hard to do it and grade it. So, okay? Any questions on this? Okay, so if that's all there was to circuits would be useless and not much fun. I mean, I guess you could light a house with batteries or something like that, but it's not particularly interesting.
And certainly not that rich a topic if that's all there is to it. Where the fun comes in is when you start putting time dependence into the circuits. So let's imagine that, let's say that we're going to look at a direct current. And let's look at a simple circuit. The simplest circuit might be one where you just have a resistor, and let's say that we even have a resistor that where we can actually change the resistance dynamically, so it has a knob. Then you might use a picture like that. So basically, the knob tells me where this conductor gets the resistance. If I'm all the way over here, I have to go through the whole resistor, so it's a big resistance. If I dial it down to here, then I can even dial it to zero. So there's some adjustable resistor here. So you might see different notations like that. So there would be a fairly simple circuit.
We often need to measure things in circuits, and you probably have done and will be doing this in lab. The two elements that we usually have to use, one is called the ammeter. And for the ammeter to work, it has to go in series in the circuit because you basically have to shove the current through the ammeter. But you don't want the ammeter itself to be changing the voltage in the circuit, so that means it has a very low resistance. So, very low resistance, but you want to actually be able to measure. So the ammeter goes in the circuit. The voltmeter, you want to measure the potential between two different points. So that is put in parallel. So you might, for example, if you want to know the voltage across this battery, you might connect the voltmeter like so, in parallel across the resistance. And now the value that you read in the voltmeter is going to be the potential difference between that point and this point. If you change the current in the circuit when you do that, then you're going to change the potential difference that you're supposed to be measuring. So you can't do that. So that means the voltmeter has a big Mongo resistance, so that basically it doesn't change the current flow in the circuit. So just be aware of that kind of thing. If you take a voltmeter and you put it in series in a circuit, you have just forced the current to go through a big Mongo resistance, and things will melt. You can ruin the voltmeter. Okay, so you need to be a little bit aware of what it is that you're actually looking at before you hook it up in the circuit, and use some care. I think also you would get in trouble if you hooked an ammeter up across a large potential difference, because you have a little resistor there, so you'll get a really massive current all of a sudden. You're basically short right across that resistor. So that could be disastrous. So be a little careful with that. At any rate, let's have some fun with it. Let's look at what's called an RC circuit. So an RC circuit, the simplest kind, would look like this. It has a resistance. It has a capacitance. And it has an EMF, which can be used to charge up the resistor and capacitor. Okay? So note that if I have this switch flipped up, then I have the EMF hooked across the resistor and the capacitor, and charge will flow and charge the capacitor. If I then flip it down, I have the capacitor effectively shorted across this resistor, and so charge will flow off the capacitor through the resistor and it will discharge. All right,
So those are the two configurations that we want to study, and those are actually different things. So we have to study them separately. So let's look at the first case where we have the switch flipped up. In that case, the circuit that we have is the EMF connected across the resistor, which is connected across the capacitor, and goes through the capacitor back to here. Now you look at it and you know what direction the current's going to flow. The capacitor is initially uncharged, and you know the current is going to go that way clockwise because of the orientation of the EMF. And remember, positive current flow is always the direction that the positive charge would go. So it's very easy to sometimes look at these problems and be thinking, oh, so the electrons will move that way. Yeah, they will, but that's not the direction of positive current flow. All right. So to understand this circuit, we use the same thinking that we have been doing. We say that the sum of the changes in the voltage as I go across each element is equal to zero. So if we mentally do a loop starting at the EMF and go around clockwise, then we know that we start out with a positive EMF. We go across the resistor in the direction of the circuit, so it's minus I times R. And now we go across the capacitor, and the voltage drop across the capacitor is going to depend on how much charge is on the capacitor at that moment, because V is equal to QC, right? So Q over C, sorry. So there will be a voltage drop across the capacitor that depends on how much charge is on the capacitor at that moment, Q over C. So the EMF minus dQ over dT times big R minus Q over C is equal to zero. As the capacitor charges up, the current's going to drop, because basically the voltage drop across the capacitor is going to counterbalance what you have across the battery. So if you look at this, I know many of you are very excited because you see that this is a differential equation. And I have to finish here in a second. We're not going to be solving differential equations really in this class for the most part. So if you've done differential equations, you look at this and you go, oh, here's the solution, and you write it down. We will study the solutions and the intuition. So the charge, as a function of time, when you solve this equation, is going to be the capacitance times the EMF times 1 minus E to the minus T over RC. So what happens is you get sort of an exponential charging of the capacitor. It drops off exponentially. It charges fast initially, and then slowly drops off. I mean, the charge increases, but it asymptotically reaches a certain value with an exponential curve. So we'll come back and study that after your break. So enjoy your fall break.